Before I start, governors, governors general, premiers, prime ministers. Anyone know the difference? About 1906, 1907 in the British Empire, they decided after Australia had federated in 1901, Canada, of course, was a dominion, they decided that the people who led the colonies that governed themselves would become prime ministers and all the state and federal ones would be premiers, as you still got today. Governor General in 1917, the title was inflated by the British government as a sort of thank you for sending all those troops to the front and being such decent chaps and chapesses in World War I. But nothing changed. So I quite often flip between the two because a lot of the premiers called themselves Prime Minister and Premier in various speeches. So that's not anything to really worry about. Now, my biggest task in both of these, in both the governors and in the PMs, is grey, degreying it. When I interviewed Kath Tizard for the Governor's General History, she said, "Why are you talking to me? Nothing happened to the Governor Generalship after George Grey." And I think still, if you ask most Kiwis, he's the only one that most people remember after Hobson, nobody since. He's a real bugbear. He's so big in the political landscape, and he's one of the few people most people will remember later in life, that my task in each of these publications and exhibitions is to try and get this pain in the butt into his right perspective. He's challenging, he's annoying, he's great, he's a villain. He's all the lot. He's like a Victorian melodrama. Now, the other thing is these bearded old buggers. You know, you look at the lists of premiers, and it's one person this month, then another, then someone comes back, and another. There we are. Yes, I can't even remember half of them if you put these things up. And there, you know, they have disappeared into greyness. They've become part of the archive rather than history itself. So I suppose, you know, the most difficult task I have is to try and bring these people alive, at least briefly, and put them into perspective. Okay. I said I'm not trained as a political historian, but a lot of my work nowadays is involved in looking at our constitution, which is a word that normally has people running for the door. New Zealand doesn't have a written constitution like the United States. You know, they all talk about constitutional amendments and their constitutional rights. Well, of course, you never hear that sort of thing in New Zealand. By the time the Treaty of Waitangi was in progress, being signed, the British constitution is largely unwritten. Most of the members of Parliament who took their seats in Auckland in 1853 would have had very little idea of what the constitution meant. It was evolving. It didn't apply to many people. Now, when New Zealanders first got the votes, some men couldn't vote. There was an age and a property limit. No women. And although it was colourblind in theory, because Maori were able to vote, because there were initially property rights, most couldn't. So this was a much wider franchise than in Britain, but it was very much a game for the middle class and for the wealthy. Okay. The other thing is that over a period of time with the British evolution, it's quite simple. The power of the cabinet grows, and with that later, the prime minister. And it's a long fight against the monarch. And I imagine you're not doing Tudors and Stuarts, which is why you're here, but it's actually very important what happened during those times with the revolution and the restoration and things like that. The monarch was effectively out of hands-on control and had been for over a century. And the new tension now was between the Prime Minister in Britain and Cabinet. So once the Prime Minister kicked the King politely to one side, next task was managing parties and cabinets. And that's still the tension nowadays with the House of Representatives here. And I said that we've got an unwritten constitution, which I think is sometimes called a flexible constitution. What it means is there's no single document like the United States. And a lot of it depends on key documents going back to Britain. There's still a lot of imperial acts still in force in New Zealand today. together with changing conventions, which is the understandings that arise over party control, the role of the Governor-General and things like that. So it's very much like this physics definition. You can actually see only very small bits in big documents. So it has a disadvantage of being very hard for people outside Parliament to understand. It has the great advantage, though, of being flexible. We can make major changes, like giving women the vote over 100 years ago, or MMP, or things like that, almost overnight by American terms. Okay, three big dates that get rattled off. I don't need to tell you about 1840. 1853, we get representative government. In other words, the Auckland Parliament that sat here could pass things, but they were recommendations that went to the governor, who still sat with his executive council. So, representative of the people, but not in charge. And then in 1856, just 3 years later, responsible government, which meant that cabinet and prime minister advised the governor, who had to follow that advice. So it was a big, big mental shift from before 1853 with no MPs, 1853 with MPs as advisors, 1856 to MPs in control of the show. But as I said, there was a bit of a complication because Gore Brown, off his own initiative, kept Native Affairs and Internal Defence, and they were actually really big issues. Elsa? There's a whole list there of the Governor-General's changes. The really big one was in 1892 when one of the governors I'll tell you about a bit later got into real trouble by not following his advice from Cabinet. And 1926, when the nature of the job changed from representing the British government and the King to just the King itself.